Hi, Jake.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. We're going to... Folks, this is the complete military march of the U.S. Army. So we're going to play it through.
That's still used by the 7th Cavalry.
That right. We'll get into that one too, Pat. It's a little too long. I'm getting some looks here. But that famous march, those of you who saw the movie of Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, they died with their boots on. Pat, our guest is Patrick Butler, who's of Irish ethnicity, I think.
Yes. Last time I looked.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that one or go there. But we went to an Irish school with a lot of Irish heritage, and I covered all the other ethnic bases except for a few.
Do you know, incidentally, that over the villa today, there are two flags flying over the villa?
They wouldn't.
One is the American flag, and one is the Irish flag. Every day, both of those flags are raised.
Oh, my goodness. By the way, Patrick, why is the flag of the Republic, why does it have orange?
Okay, the orange, all right, this was an interesting story behind that. The orange, green, and white was designed by Thomas Maher, who later became one of the generals in the New York Irish Brigade. The green, of course, is for us. The orange was for the loyalists, mostly Protestants, and the white was the hope of eventual peace between the two. That was designed in 1848 during one of the revolts, which did represent an alliance of both persuasions.
Oh, well, that's an interesting year, because that's the year that all the monarchs on the thrones of Europe had their thrones shaken.
Oh, yes, yes.
And was there a lot of Irish immigration about that time?
Yeah, partly because of the revolutions over there, but also partly because of the famine. Remember, the famine started in 1846, and it really was not until 1850 that things started to improve a little bit. Remember, a third of the population died, a third of the population emigrated, and a third of the population was left by 1850.
Now, the ones that came here to our shores, now, you explored the connection of there were army recruiters at the docks.
Yes.
Go ahead. We'll get into that a little bit.
During the Civil War, and you'll see it in the movie, and I'm sure that most of your listeners have seen the Gangs of New York. You'll see it in the movie where these guys are getting off the ships and waiting at the docks are recruiters for various regiments of the Union Army. Same thing could have been done in any southern port because what side you fought on largely depended on where your ship landed. And so the story goes, these guys, of course, were given the first decent suit of clothes they'd ever had, probably the first decent meal they'd seen in a couple years, and, you know, an opportunity for a fairly steady income. So, you know, recruiting was not difficult. It didn't get difficult until about 1863, and then they introduced the draft. They also introduced the practice of being able to buy a substitute. If you were a wealthy person, you didn't have to go to war. You put up $300, and that money would be used to buy someone who'd never seen $300 in his life.
Now, since we jumped a little bit ahead, and I want to get into the Irish role in the militaries around the world. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Mexican War, tell us a little bit about the San Patricio.
Okay. During the Mexican War, remember the Mexican War began right around the time of the famine. So you were getting boatloads of people coming over here and immediately being recruited into the army. An army, incidentally, which was at that time very, very biased, very, very prejudiced. And they might just as well have stayed home because they were treated exactly the same way. when they got into Mexico, several hundred defected to the Mexican side. Remember, the Mexicans offered them land. The Mexicans weren't going to persecute them for their religion.
They're Catholic, too, supposedly.
Exactly, after a fashion. And, you know, they weren't going to be discriminated against in terms of promotion and that kind of thing. So they really saw no reason why they should be fighting for these people that were, you know, only going to restrict and persecute them. They might as well have stayed in England. So they did defect. Now, we, of course, in the United States regard the San Patricio incident as a case of, you know, high treason, which technically it was. But the Mexicans regard these people as national heroes. To this day, they have a ceremony about 20 miles outside of Mexico City. There's a monument to the San Patricios. And they have the Irish representatives there, and they have the Mexican officials, sometimes even the president. And they lay a wreath at this monument. And, you know, it's just part of their... They regard them the same way we regard Pulaski and Kosciuszko and people like that that you know, came from elsewhere to fight you know, on our side.
Well,
so,
do you remember the movie? I forgot the name of the movie, you know, that depicted this. I thought it was fairly accurate, especially
One Man's Hero was.
Oh yes, and is it accurate?
It's pretty accurate. It really is.
So it is accurate that that one guy was horsewhipped, and then they branded him on the wrong cheek, and they ordered him branded on the correct cheek. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
Ooh, horrible.
In fact, all of the ones who weren't hanged, and there were about, I think there were about 80 who were hanged. The ones who weren't hanged were all branded.
And then they were what, kicked out of the, they were drummed
then
out
they,
as it were?
Then they were drummed out, yeah. And of course,
did any stay in Mexico, or
yes,
do we know the fate?
Many went into Mexico. Many stayed in Mexico. Some of the officers of the San Patricio Brigade transferred into the Mexican Army and became officers there. Others just, you know, faded into history. They knew that if they returned to the United States, with that brand on them, they'd, you know, be you know, forever hounded. So
yeah. By the way, folks, our topic today is some of the things you didn't know about the Irish and some of the things that you don't want to know about that race. So we'll get into that a little later in this extended program. It's 45 minutes today. Pat, now since we're on the military kick, do you remember the movie The Long Gray Line? With,
yes.
Yeah. Is that accurate?
It is accurate. There was a guy by the name of Martin Maher who
good Irish
was,
name.
Yeah, who was literally at West Point for 50 years. He came as a dishwasher. because of the fact that he had clumsily broken so many dishes he could never hope to pay for them as a dishwasher, they offered him the opportunity to go into the Army. And he took that. The pay was fairly decent for 1903. And eventually became an instructor at West Point. He retired as a sergeant major. He couldn't become an officer because he was, because they weren't making people of his persuasion officers in 1903. There wasn't a war on. If there had been a war on, they'd have been happy to. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he retired in 1953, and literally he was brought to the White House for his retirement ceremony.
Uh-huh.
And they show that in the movie, The Long Gray Line.
Yeah.
Most of what's in that movie is very true.
And Maureen O'Hara played his wife. Good Irish lad. With the red hair and all.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we
and Tyrone Power, I mean, come on.
We all grew up, regarding Maureen O'Hara as, the ultimate in feminine pulchritude. So.
Well, it depends on which ethnicity you prefer. I like the big bulkeries. Now, what is it about the Irish and the various militaries of the world? We had, besides the San Patricio, there was, I think, a guy named O'Banion who fought in the wars with Simon Bolivar against the Spanish, liberation of South America. You know something about that?
Oh, sure, sure. In the first place, bear in mind, now you went to school with us, so you know that we'll do anything to avoid honest labor.
And then some.
Right, which is why we go into politics, we go into
and the
law,
priesthood.
We go into the priesthood, we go into journalism, anything to regard really breaking a sweat.
And bootlegging.
So, you know, and bear in mind, incidentally, the Army had a special appeal. Because you're talking about people who, for 300 years, were not allowed to hold any rank whatever in the civil or military arms of the government, were not allowed to be taught to read and write, were not allowed to own a gun, were not allowed to own a horse worth more than $25.
Really?
Again, we'll get into the penal laws, which are basically the inspiration for the Nuremberg Laws.
Wow.
But, Cromwell came up with a series of laws which were designed to finish off anybody, any groups that he didn't like. And, of course, Hitler took basically those same ideas and almost copied them word for word into the Nuremberg Laws.
Ah. Now, excuse me, what is it about, also we forgot Australia. Do you want to get in a little of that, the Irish?
Australia was a place where they would send you for petty crimes because the jails in England and Ireland were full, and they needed people to colonize Australia. So you would get sentenced to 7 years transportation or transportation for life. Now, we're not talking about a gold BART card or a gold CTA card. We are talking about you being transported to Australia.
It took about, half a year?
It took the better part of about 9 months.
Yeah, they called it, there's a famous book by Robert Hughes, a great book, The Far Shore or The Fatal Shore.
Fatal Shore.
I highly recommend it.
Book. Yeah, I read it too. It's a very good book. It goes into it. But the interesting thing is that, you would be sent there, and after 7 years, you would be a free man but would not be allowed to return to England or Ireland, largely because of the fact that probably the reason you were sent there in the first place was for sedition. And so they didn't want you going back doing the same sort of stuff that you were doing before. So you could stay in Australia, and there were cases of guys who came there as convicts and ended up as Chief Justice of the New South Wales Supreme Court, head of the South Australia Police Force. one of the generals of the Australian Territorial Army, that kind of thing. And one of the guys who came over to Australia and escaped from Australia was a guy named Thomas Maher, the one that designed the flag. Thomas Maher escaped. He went to New York, became a lawyer, and at the beginning of the Civil War, he was active in setting up the Irish Brigade. And I'm sure that your readers, or listeners rather, have seen the movie The Fighting 69th, which was about the Irish Brigade.
Yeah, with James Cagney.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so Maher, or you know, known in some circles as Maher of the Sword, fought in the Civil War with distinction. After the Civil War, he became part of a Fenian plot to invade Canada.
Yes, they were always trying to invade Canada.
which very nearly brought the United States to the brink of war with Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Reason being, they're Fenians. They changed into green caps, but the uniforms were American. And so one fine morning, the British wake up and they see all of these bluecoats charging one of their forts. And they, of course, assumed that it was an American invasion. They didn't know why until next to the American flag was an Irish flag. And so they assumed the United States was somehow involved in this. And it took a lot of diplomatic legerdemain in order to, you know, avoid near hostilities.
We should.
Maher then went west after the war and became governor of Kansas.
Hmm.
Then he went to Montana and became governor of Montana. And he.
These weren't territories, weren't at the time?
They were territories.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's
and you
how
were,
I got away
you
with
were
it.
Appointed. No, you were appointed to territorial governor by the president. You were not elected. And Maher died a mysterious death. In the 1870s, he was on a cruise in the Pacific and not too far from San Francisco. And he either jumped or was pushed off the deck.
Well,
the suspicion is no. The suspicion is that he may have been pushed by an old enemy because, look, Fenian politics makes what goes on in the Middle East look like child's play.
Oh, yes, they kneecap people and other things.
Well, you know,
the
Fenians were not only going after the Brits, they were going after each other because there were various factions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here in Chicago, there are a couple unsolved murders that definitely had to do with the Fenian groups in the 1880s. But were never solved.
So these are still open cases.
They're still open cases.
Yeah. Well, now, when did the in World War II, it said that the top the British top commanders Montgomery, Alexander, who's the other? Auchinleck. I don't know about Auchinleck, but several of them were of Northern Irish ancestry. Is
yeah. Well, Wellington was too.
Oh, Wellington. Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
In fact, I
the Protestant Irish.
I saw Wellington's house when I was in Dublin, the house where he was born.
Yeah,
and his brother was Arthur Wesley. James Wesley. John
right,
Wesley,
he was the younger son, so they went into the army.
Founded Methodism.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What I like about Wellington is when his mistress threatened to publish, he said, "Publish and be damned."
I got a better Wellington story. It was a case of at one of the battles. I don't know if it was Waterloo or what, but it was a fairly significant battle, and one of Wellington's staff officers had been hit by a cannon shot, and the ball knocked him off the horse.
Oh, yeah, that was at Waterloo.
And this officer is clutching what's left of his leg, and he says, "My lord, I've lost my leg." And Wellington just turned. He was still on his horse, and he just looked at the man and says, "My God, you have."
Yeah, that scene is in the The Russian director Bonachuk's version of Waterloo with Rod Steiger, who played Napoleon, and Christopher Plummer played
Wellington.
Wellington. And Jack Hawkins was his subordinate who lost his leg. And that scene is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now Wellington was no one. He was Prime Minister of England. He was, anti-Catholic. Is that accurate?
Yes, this is true.
Isn't that interesting, coming from Ireland?
He was also, well, yeah, but remember, the country was divided, and it wasn't just divided along sectarian lines. It was divided along class lines.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Remember, Wellington, although he was, born in Dublin, he had no problem rising up the ranks of the British Army. But if you were of the wrong persuasion, you were not supposed to go higher than sergeant.
When did the British Army start accepting Irish? Was it the Crimean War or what?
Well, no. As a matter of fact, they'd been accepting Irishmen for the British Army all along. Remember, 70% of Wellington's troops at Waterloo were not English at all.
Oh, I didn't know.
They were Irish.
Scots, great.
And Scottish, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the only problem was, though, that they couldn't be promoted beyond the NCO ranks. However, the way they got around that was they simply ignored the fact that the person was of a different persuasion. For example, there was a very famous British general in the Boer War, Sir William P. Butler. I don't know if he's a relation. I really don't. But he was from the same part of Ireland that we were. Anyway, he had been a practicing Catholic, got into the British Military Academy. Sandhurst, everyone just kind of looked the other way.
Mm-hmm.
By the 1880s and 90s, he was by that time a general who had dinner regularly with the Queen. And, when that was called to her attention, she simply drew herself up in her haughty Victorian fashion and said, "We do not discuss these things in this house."
Well, she's the same one who didn't believe in lesbianism. Women don't do these things. Something like that. By the way, since we're gonna move along here, the history of the House of Nassau and a USS
Nassau.
Yep. Which is Orange, the House of Orange.
Yep.
Now, were you aware, Patrick, that William the Silent, I think, was one of the forebears of William of Nassau, who went to Ireland and defeated the Irish Catholics at the Battle of the Boyne? But were you aware of his ancestor was the first guy to be assassinated by a handgun?
No, but I'll tell you something else about, you mentioned the Battle of the Boyne. William of Orange was being backed by the Pope, whereas James and the Irish legions were being backed by the Saxon electors.
Ah, interesting.
I mean, it politics makes very, very strange bedfellows.
Yeah, I call it strange litter mates.
Yeah.
Well, oh no! Now the wild geese. We're just getting a little of this. Now they were. Tell us who they were
and the relationship
to De Gaulle and Marshal MacMahon.
Okay, the wild geese were those lords and earls who fled the country after some of the major defeats, such as the Battle of the Boyne, that kind of thing. They fled to France because the King of France was always looking for a few good men. And their descendants became part and parcel of the French establishment, especially the French army. The second president after Adolphe Thiers, after the fall of Napoleon III, second president was a French general by the name of Patrick MacMahon. And Patrick MacMahon was descended from wild geese.
So, the ones who fled after, and also there's the Battle of Frontenac. Now, Charles de Gaulle is also a descendant his family?
Charles de Gaulle was part Irish.
Ah, okay, that explains.
Yeah.
Now, today, we're going to move to religion. Today is the birthday of Pope John Paul II. And the Catholic Church is getting the shellacking unfairly, I think, because their Protestants and Jews also have pedophile problems. And there's some controversy about how he dealt with or didn't deal with pedophilia among the Catholic clergy. Now, what is it about the Irish? It seems more Irish names in the clergy seem to come up in these pedophile cases. Can you expand on that?
Who do you think represents the majority of the clergy in the United States? I mean,
it's a mistake, but
numerically, if you have any profession which attracts a large number of any group of people, both the heroes and villains of that profession are going to be that group of people.
So now the Irish.
There's no gene. If you're dancing around wondering if we have this perverse gene that makes some of us do these things, no.
Well, now there. I don't know if this is folklore, if this is popular psychology, but there seems to be. We've heard this for years that the Irish men avoid getting married. Or they have these hang-ups about sexuality. Although that's changed with this new generation, I understand.
Okay, there are historical and economic reasons for that.
Okay.
You're talking, and I'm sure that your listeners are well aware of the fact that it had, until very recently, been probably the poorest country in Europe. And
well, it's coming full circle because of the euro.
the fact is that that's changing. But for many, many years, it was the poorest country in Europe. And when you have a country with absolutely no prospects, guys are going to tend to get married much, much later, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it. As far as the ultra-Puritan attitudes, which were especially prevalent during the time of Éamon de Valera's Ireland, you know, right after independence in the 30s and 40s, you know, when all kinds of things were prohibited. They made some Muslim countries look like California. The truth of the matter is that comes from Jansenism. Now,
okay.
the Jansenists were mostly Dutch who were reacting to the wave of Puritanism in the 16th century. And that was simply the Roman version of Puritanism. The only difference is the French and the Dutch, they tried it out and found it wanting. but in parts of Ireland, they stuck with it for a couple hundred years.
Now, what's the origin of the phrase Black Irish?
Okay, that's people with dark complected, probably descended from the early Celts, or possibly descended from some of the Spaniards who landed on the coast of Ireland after the destruction of the Spanish Armada in 1588.
Okay, because Nixon was accused of being Black Irish. Now, how did
probably
he,
was.
Yeah, how do we? Yesterday was Pat Nixon's birthday. Long-suffering. Well, she was Quaker. How did Éamon de Valera? Tell us a little bit about him. How did a Spaniard
born in the United States? Because Éamon de Valera's father was Spanish, his mother was Irish. He was born in New York. He got involved in the Irish Brotherhood in New York, and as things started heating up in Ireland, he went over there and joined the Republican Brotherhood, which was one of the precursors of the IRA. And he was a totally uncharismatic mathematics professor who just happened to be in the right place at the right time. he was not like a Michael Collins who could, you know, inspire you to do all kinds of things.
By the way, did he have anything to do with the assassination of Collins?
Ooh, that's open to question.
Oh, really? I thought so.
That's open to question. As a matter of fact, once I had literally tea with De Valera's granddaughter And that was one subject I definitely did not bring up.
I see.
She was, when I met her, a cabinet minister.
Oh, okay.
And
you would have been put on the first plane out.
Well, no, she was over here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But you know, you don't raise questions like that if you don't have to.
Oh, right, right. You know? No. She's not responsible anyway.
But no, but I mean, we don't know. And much of what's in the movie Michael Collins is pretty accurate.
Yeah, I recommend that movie for people. I always say there's a lot of great movies which are very accurate history. It's not only entertaining, but it's informative.
Now, you know that Michael Collins has relatives living here in Chicago.
Oh, I didn't know. Well, there's so many Collinses. It's a big plan.
No, these are his relatives. Here's what happened. Michael Collins' brother came to Chicago, joined the police force.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Collins' brother sent letters to Michael Collins urging him to leave, come over here, and get on the Chicago police force. And he probably, I mean, he'd had no problem doing that in those days. And he chose to stay. There are relatives of Michael Collins here in Chicago who have some of his memorabilia, including the cap that he may have been wearing the day that he was shot.
Or assassinated. Or,
same thing.
He almost ended up against the firing squad wall.
Yeah.
The Easter Rebellion, yes.
Yeah, well now, as a matter of fact, Ahmed De Valera would have been shot if he were not an American.
Right, yeah.
He was one of the leaders of the Rising, and I don't know how much your listeners know about that, but that was one of these things that if you knew the right people, the worst they would do to you would be to lock you up for a couple of years. If you were dangerous beyond belief, why then you got shot. And Ahmed De Valera was one of the people they dearly wanted to shoot, except that President Woodrow Wilson contacted the British Prime Minister and asked that his sentence be commuted. So it was, which kind of disappointed De Valera, because De Valera was one of these sanctimonious sorts that craved martyrdom.
Oh, yeah, puritanical and all of that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
now, part of our topic today is some of the things you didn't want to know about the Irish, and I should bring this up because it's related to the Stephen Neri case, U.S. Navy sailor, 15 years in prison, which has cost the American taxpayer $15 million, and we're going to get into that next Tuesday. The entire show will be devoted to that, plus our YouTube, Amicus Veritas site. Some of the things you didn't know about Argentine neo-Nazi Juan Piferre. But anyway, there's an interesting connection of assassination of a British peace emissary during the, I think it was the Gladstone administration. The Hallinan family in San Francisco, it depends how you look at them. Vincent Hallinan was the American Communist Party's candidate in 1950. Or 52, in the Eisenhower, Stevenson campaign, and he was the Communist Party's nominee for president. He also spent some time in Terminal Island, shady real estate dealings. But his father, Patrick Hallinan, was involved in the assassination of, I forgot the guy's name, shame on me, but anyway, he fled to San Francisco, and they couldn't be extradited, and became a streetcar driver. And his son Vincent became the lawyer for the corrupt Longshoremen's Union, and his children became two of them became lawyers, Patrick Hallinan, and then the other Hal Keo, who became the prosecutor of San Francisco, and a lot of sleazy things, called the most corrupt prosecutor in the whole state of California. But we'll get into some of that. But what is interesting is that the grandson of the assassinated British official married Adele Astaire, the older sister of Fred Astaire. And in the Fred Astaire movies, the fop was Edward Everett Horton. Now, his niece was the probate judge in this case, and she also served in the OSS in World War II. It's a fascinating history that I got into, but it's typical. It's just like that Swedish official who went to Palestine, as it was known then, to try to broker peace between the Arabs and the the Jews or whatever at that in 1948, and he was assassinated by the Ergun, Begin in that crowd. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that these are some of the things that the Irish are in the Hallinan case. It's fascinating, and it's not very well known. But what is it, Patrick, about now? And we're both from lived in the Chicago area. You've lived there all your life. And we by our school, the Irish mob, what was it, Bugs Moran had his still there in
No,
Mudville?
That was Tui. That was Roger Tui.
Oh, Roger Tui. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Now, what is it about, how is it, why is it that the Irish, they're smarter than the Italians, but the Italians always seem to get the upper hand, especially the St. Valentine's Day
massacre? Because we frankly are not as vicious as they are. I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, Who goes around kneecapping your opponents?
Well, yeah, except for the fact, do you know what the Sicilians would have done?
I dread to think, and I don't think my listeners even though this is a mature version of... No, this is for everyone, so we...
But the fact of the matter is, for example, the mafia was involved in white slavery. The mafia was involved in forced prostitution. The mafia was involved in dope. And quite frankly, in the 1920s and 30s, the Irish gangsters had no part of any of that.
Well, how do you explain the gangs of New York now? Is that accurate, that the Irish were involved in terrorizing everybody?
Sure. But then again, the other side was, too.
Oh, okay.
That
so that makes, it all right.
That was extortion, and that was the 1840s, and that was the worst slums in the Western world at that time. And the conditions they describe in that movie are pretty accurate. Incidentally, there is a book out. The movie is based on a book written by a historian who goes into that whole period in New York. It's pretty accurate. He also did a book on the history of Chicago crime, and he also did a history on the criminal element in New Orleans and in San Francisco. Herbert Salisbury.
Right.
So it's well worth reading. You can get the book Gangs of New York. It's still in print.
Oh, okay.
It's still in now, paperback. Get it.
Yeah.
I urge all your listeners to do that. It's a good read.
We'll keep promoting it. Now, in 1938, today, on March 18th, in Mexico, President Cardenas nationalized the British and the American oil interests who were engaging in predatory business practices. Now, few people know that the Bill Buckley family, his father, was one of those oil buccaneers that went down there and made their money. I guess he got out with most of it. And that was the foundation of the Buckley family, the Bill Buckley and the New Republican. And there are questions about this, you know, his connection with Yale and what's that awful group?
Skull and Bones.
Yeah, Skull and Bones, right.
Yeah.
And various, a lot of these guys went into OSS and later into the CIA, and of course, Americans still don't realize that spying is a necessary thing. We never understood it. They think it's like Nathan Hale. By the way, was he Irish?
No, he was English. But interestingly enough, you know, you talk about the American aversion to spying. but the fact of the matter is that as recently as the First World War, and I mean, historically speaking, that's mm-hmm. pretty recent. When it was suggested at the very beginning of our entry into the war that we set up a good network of intelligence agents, the then Secretary of War said, quote, "Gentlemen do not read each other."
Oh, that was Henry L. Stimson. He was around too long.
And, of course, Wilson, President Wilson, you know, you would think a president with, you know, real backbone would have immediately fired the guy for terminal stupidity.
Wasn't he a bit, didn't he resegregate Washington, and wasn't he a bit of a prude to say the least?
Oh, yeah,
And, and the Federal Reserve, that racket.
Well, to give you an idea,
and he wasn't Irish.
No, he definitely wasn't.
And he wasn't Catholic.
Toward the end of the war, the French presented the Americans with a bill for trench rent.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
I didn't know this one.
And Wilson sent it to Congress with the recommendation that
we pay?
That we pay it. Now, picture, if you will, let's move the film reel back about 15 years to when Teddy Roosevelt was president. Imagine what would have happened if you would have presented that bill to TR. Where he would have told you to stick that bill.
And he'd be using his big stick.
Well, he wouldn't have had to, because, you see, Teddy Roosevelt was an accomplished boxer.
Yeah. Oh, Patrick, since we opened, I know, and there's a famous movie about him sending the Marines over to Morocco.
And that's incidentally based on an actual occurrence.
You're right. That's a very accurate. I highly recommend it, because there were some issues that are very relevant to today, and that's what we try to do with this program. Incidentally, since we opened the program with Gary Owen, you told me that during the Russo-Japanese War, which Teddy Roosevelt brokered peace because he didn't like to see a yellow race beating up on a white race.
Right.
But you mentioned that the Japanese army marched to Gary Owen at one point?
That's correct. When they marched into Port Arthur after it was taken from the Russians, the Japanese army band was playing Gary Owen. Where did they learn that? Well, the fact of the matter is that the Japanese had been trained by German and Irish drill masters.
Oh, I know about the Germans, and actually
their
national anthem, I forgot the name, was the guy who composed it was trained by German musicians.
Japanese national anthem?
Yes.
Yeah, Kimi Gaio.
Yeah, you know it better than I do.
Yeah, it's got a Japanese tone to it, but it decidedly has Western notes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On every, just to digress along music, on New Year's Day in Japan, they always play Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's the big big music piece. I guess they really well. They've always liked the Germans,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Sometimes they've liked them too much.
Well, Patrick, this has been great. I'm going to end with Brian Boru. Oh, give us a little bit about Brian Boru. We got a minute or two.
Brian Boru, and that's the subject of the music that your listeners are going to hear in a minute or two.
Yeah, not the March of the Scaffold.
Brian Boru was credited with driving the last of the major Viking invasions out of Ireland.
What year was that, roughly?
Oh, that was the Battle of Clondorf. That would be, I think it was like in the 1000s.
Mm.
Okay.
And, of course, you see these great Irish wolfhounds. In fact, I saw one today when I was out at the kennel. But those were his dogs, right? Didn't he have
Mm-hmm. But he in effect made the first move toward uniting the country, because prior to that time, the country was ruled by a bunch of regional kings, answerable, formally anyway, to a high king who lived in Tara. But the high king had no little power to really enforce his dictums. So guys like Brian Boru and others united the island just at about the same time that England was being united.
Oh, real quick, Patrick, I haven't been in Ireland. I've been over it in a Pan Am jet.
It really looks like
an emerald in the ocean
on
a clear day. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But now, what's the origin of this Blarney Stone? I asked somebody from Ireland about it.
Okay.
And he was one of these Irish contractors, and he said, I said, you kissed the Blarney Stone. He says, no, I own it. And I said, at least you won't be building these shacks on it.
Okay, the Blarney Stone is a stone in a tower in Blarney Castle. You have to kiss the Blarney Stone, you have to climb a ladder down backwards, lean your head back while someone holds your feet, and then kiss the stone. That supposedly gives you the gift of eloquence.
Well, we know all the Irish are pulling Blarney.
When I was there, it was rainy, and it was considered unsafe to go up the narrow steps and climb down the ladder there because it was all very slippery. And I voiced a certain amount of disappointment, and the tour guide, who had gotten to know me by that time, and she says, Pat, you've already got the gift. You don't need to go through this exercise.
And we'll end with Brian Boru. Thank you, Patrick. We'll do this again. I think people loved it.
We'll talk soon.
Signing off with Brian Boru. Thanks, Patrick. This is Peter Paul Verzola. Thanks for listening. Okay. Okay. Now we have that. It's too regular. I want to do.
That was a great show, I thought.
That's not a good thing.
Yeah, no.
I've got to get credit. Because I've been very critical that it's not created a lot of jobs even with the stimulus money. But apparently, there's going to be a lot of jobs created here
in the IRS.
Well, this is something you've highlighted. Why don't I give you a chance to explain?
Well, we're finding out now, Sean, that about 16,500 new jobs will be created in the IRS for a very important reason. The IRS will be tasked with breathing down the neck of 300 million Americans every month to determine whether we have purchased governmentally acceptable levels of health insurance. Not only 300 individual Americans will they be checking, they'll also be checking the employers. And if either the employers or the individual Americans, fail to have minimally acceptable insurance for government purposes, we're fined. We're fined $2,250 or 2% of our income. Also, confidential taxpayer information will be shared with the Department of Health and Human Services. It goes on and on, Sean, the expansion of the IRS into our lives. But just imagine, we'll be audited. They'll have the right to confiscate our tax refunds. The IRS will be in really a new social welfare agency. Can you imagine? They're the enforcers of this health care plan. The IRS, for heaven's sake. If that doesn't bring discomfort to the American people, I don't know what will.
You know, I thought I heard it all, Congresswoman, when Nancy Pelosi said, we have to tax the bill to find out what's in the bill. I thought I heard it all. And then sure enough, I go to the Judge Report, and you got this Virginia Congressman, what's his name, Tom Perriello, or I don't know if you know him. And he actually says, if you don't tie our hands, excuse me, we will keep stealing. Did you hear that? It's bizarre, but take a look at the conversation that Brett Baer had with President Obama. President Obama essentially said the same thing as Speaker Pelosi. He said, when we pass this bill, I'll know what's in it, and you'll know what's in it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
When we pass the bill, that's finally when we're going to know what's in it. I'm a member of Congress. I can't even fully know yet what's in this bill that we're expected to vote on Sunday. It's ridiculous.
The president has lowest approval ratings ever. You're going to be a part of a rally that's going to be on Capitol Hill this weekend. There's been a lot of rallies that we've watched. Give me your best guess. Do you think the Democrats can pull this off?
Well, it depends. The rally will be at noon on the west side of the Capitol. We need every American to come down and be here. This is the final effort. There won't be any more rallies.
this is our last time to come and press these Democrat members of Congress to finally listen to the people. We're getting all of the very bad news on the table. This should be enough to motivate everyone to do whatever it takes to come to the Capitol, the West Side, noon on Saturday. John Voight will be there, the actor. Other speakers are lining up right now. We're going to have a great time, but more than that, the case needs to be made. We want to urge everyone to come down. We need them.
From all indications, this is going to be one of the closest votes ever in history and one of the most corrupt, unethical in terms of process.
But we can kill it. We can kill it.
Kill the bill. I agree. For the sake of our kids and grandkids, this is a bad bill. The process is bad. The corruption is unprecedented. Congresswoman, we'll watch for you on Saturday. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, John.
All right, we got a busy night. Lots more Hannity coming up. Straight ahead.
Introducing a new vacuum cleaner that works overtime, day and night. New absorbing bubbles extender clean. A powerful sprayer that lets the bubbles do the cleaning. Just spray and wipe. Then let the water-activated formula take care of your bathroom.
Let's go!
For up to 4 days. New scrubbing bubbles extender clean. We work overtime, so you don't have to.
A family company. Which snack do you prefer? One that's full of sugar and artificial ingredients?
Or one that's full of wholesome flavor? Discover cheese snacks from Sargento. The delicious yet nutritious alternative to ordinary snacks. From pepper jack and reduced fat Kobe Jack sticks to mozzarella string cheese, our flavorful natural cheese snacks are individually wrapped so you can snack smarter anywhere, anytime. Sargento, for snickety people, exceptional cheese.
Any one product can take all of it.
could you do all that?
PCmatic.com. Go to PCmatic.com for a free PC performance game. That's PCmatic.com.
The town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, is preparing to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the epic Civil War battle that occurred there and the historic speech delivered on the battlefield by President Lincoln 4 months later. After marking the occasion, the organizers of the event have called on the Anointed One to deliver his own version of the Gettysburg Address. Now, just one problem. Well, the anniversary does not occur until July of 2013. So I guess the organizers of the event are counting on him mounting a successful re-election bid. Now, I wouldn't be so sure about that. Now, if the Anointed One does speak, I'm guessing that he's going to, well, probably run a little longer than Lincoln's 272 words. And I assume that he, unlike Lincoln, will use a teleprompter. Now, Vice President Biden had the honor of giving the opening remarks at yesterday's St. Patrick's Day reception at the White House, for which Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowan was in attendance. Now, the Vice President gave the Prime Minister one of his characteristic introductions. Let's take a look.
His mom lived in Long Island for 10 years or so, God rest her soul, and although she quit, your mom's still alive as your dad passed. God bless her soul.
But I guess that was a real smooth recovery, Mr. Vice President. But this time it might be easier just to get your facts straight from the start. That'll be easy. And outgoing Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd's ethics troubles could soon be spreading to members of his own staff. Now, according to Bloomberg News, in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, Senator Dodd's chief counsel was trading stocks of several companies that were being considered for bailouts. Now, the woman's name is Amy Friend, who serves on Chairman Dodd's Senate Banking Committee staff. Now, financial disclosure documents show that as the committee debated whether or not to save companies like AIG, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo, Friend purchased stakes in four banks worth thousands of dollars. Now, meanwhile, on the Republican side of the banking committee, Bloomberg reports no staff members owned stock in the bailout companies in 2008. What a shock. I guess the swamp still needs to be drained. Now, the White House says President Obama is so intensely involved in healthcare negotiations that he is once again postponing his trip to Indonesia and Australia. However, the Anointed One did find some time on his so-called busy schedule to talk to ESPN's Andy Katz. And for the second year in a row, the president made his pitch for the NCAA men's basketball tournament public. Unfortunately, the all-knowing first fan ran into a little bit of trouble while filling out his bracket this year. Let's take a look.
I guess there are a few songs on. I'm going to be honest. I just completely left it up. It's quite on. Come on. Sorry, guys. Molly and Sasha are going to tease me about this.
All right, they're not the only ones, Mr. President. The Syracuse fans are lighting up the blogs. They're not too happy with you either. And that is the news tonight from Hannity's America. Coming up, one congressional candidate is making a bizarre promise, but it may just be what we need in Congress. We're going to tell you what that is and much more. Straight ahead.
If we don't know how many people there are, how do we know how many roads we need? The census office knows exactly what we need. So everyone can get their fair share of funding. We can't move forward until you mail it back.
When cold symptoms threaten to take Ohio owner's power, we take Big Stayquil. Get your power back. Big Stayquil. Powerful daytime cold and flu symptom relief.
Companies that want brilliant color are moving to EcoFit printers from Kyocera. Companies that need crisp black and white are also making the move. Companies that are smart about saving money are making the wise choice. And these days, we all understand that money isn't the only thing worth saving. Makes you wonder why some companies aren't making the move. Economical, ecological, EcoFit printers from Kyocera. We're people friendly.
Dollar Days at Pep Boys. Put in three installed Affinity tires and get the fourth for a buck instantly. Pennzoil, do-it-yourself oil change, just $15. Champion Platinum Spark Plug, $1 each. Black Magic Tire Wet, 2 bottles, just $3. When the light comes on, just come in.
Pep Boys, just have that place for it.
Call
Jeff Boyd or visit CutBoyd.com.
A Republican congressional candidate in Tennessee is bringing now new meaning to the term accountability. Stephen Fisher told a crowd in North Jackson yesterday, quote, "If I don't do what I say, I'll give you my address, and you can bring a rope and you can hang me," adding, "I'll probably pay for that when I'm elected." I'm sure he didn't mean that literally, but it seems he's trying to be refreshing. Back with Frank Lloyd in 2 short minutes.
Secretary Neil Betchikoff of Capital One, we get double miles with every purchase, so we earn a tropical vacation in half the time.
We earn double miles every time we use our car.
Yeah. Double miles out of farm, so we can bring the whole gang. It's hard to beat double miles. Everyone knows two is better than one.
Introducing the Venture Card from Capital One. With double miles on every purchase every day. Go to CapitalOne.com.
Let's do your one. Why not?
From the goodness of almonds comes the pure deliciousness of new pure almonds from Silva. Smooth and crisp, all-natural almond milk that power you up with antioxidants for just 60 calories of life. New pure almonds from Silva. Strength in every form. In original and vanilla flavor.
Stay 3 nights and get a fortnight free, plus free command airfare, only in Atlanta.
Lexmark presents Instinct Monsters, the Moolah Sucker, the diabolically expensive creature ink that empties your pockets with every drop, devouring your budget. Outsmart evil agents. The award-winning Lexmark Professional Touchscreen All-in-One with the world's lowest black ink cost. Just $4.99 for a 500-page cartridge. So long, ink monster. Lexmark. Go way beyond printing.
So all the talk on Capitol Hill today was about one subject, health care. Now, the Republicans, the Democrats in the White House, they all made themselves heard, but who made the best arguments in their attempts to persuade you, the American people? And joining me now with answers is pollster, president of The Word Doctors, Frank Luntz is here. Mr. Luntz, welcome back.
This has been the most wonderful week for those of us who analyze language.
Okay, but, you know, a little nerve-wracking for those of us that actually believe in the Constitution, the rule of law, and not wanting to see the best healthcare system taken over by government, but I understand what you're saying. All right, well, let's start with this. This is the propaganda, cheap propaganda, Robert did with a reporter and asked about if the American people support demon tax. Here's Robert did.
It's unclear what legislative process the speaker will use, and I'll let her decide and announce that. I think the president was pretty clear yesterday, just as I was the day before that, that everyone knows what this vote is. Everyone knows what this vote is about.
Tell the American people, yes or no, I want the speaker to do this, or no.
Some
Democrats are saying it will harm the credibility of the process.
Well, I think that the president is of the strong belief, and quite frankly, watching CNN, it appears that you all are of the strong belief that the vote that we're going to have on Sunday is about whether we're going to have health care reform or not. I don't sense that the stories that are coming out are where you are on the rule.
All right, so Frank, how do you do?
Can you do that well? This is one of those rare cases when process actually does matter. It's not just what you do, it's how you do it. And the American people have been frustrated. They've been frustrated because the legislation is 2,700 pages long. They've been frustrated because they haven't had the ability to read it. They've been frustrated because now that they've got this final semi-legislation, they're only going to have 72 hours to look at it. Look, Sean, up until now, the thing you could say about members of Congress if you were mad at them is that they didn't read the legislation they were passing. For the first time, you can now actually say about members of Congress that they're passing legislation that they haven't even written yet. Well, it's even worse than that. And what they did today was they passed what they allowed legislation to be passed without even really voting on the legislation because they were too cowardly. that a fair characterization?
But I don't know if I'm going to use the word cowardly. I would say that there isn't accountability.
Wait a minute.
That's what the American people are looking for more than any other attribute.
No, no. If they wouldn't vote on this legislation because they knew they would lose. So they had to come up with this cockamamie rule change late in the game, parliamentary maneuvers in the Senate. This is cowardly because this is their only grail, isn't it?
Well, most Americans, if you ask Americans that question, if you just raised by 3-1, the American people would agree with you. But, Sean, I'm a language guy, and so I want to focus on what they're saying and how the American people are reacting.
All right, let's go to Nancy Pelosi responding to why it's been hard to acquire the votes that are. Here's what she said.
Every vote is a heavy lift. We have great diversity in our caucus. We don't have a rubber stamp Congress or a rubber stamp caucus. So we have our full airing of issues. Members want to see the figures. They want to see what the Senate will do. We like the dynamic in our caucus. But it does show also, in second part, it also does show the impact of a campaign of misrepresentation, of fear that is going out there. There is no limit to what the other side will do to protect the insurance companies.
Wow, and they're the ones that met with the pharmaceutical companies. How'd that go over?
We don't have a rubber stamp Congress. Make no mistake. When someone says we don't have X, it means that's exactly what they have. And when she said that it is a demonstration of the other side and its promotion of fear, the fact is she's actually disqualifying those who are opposed to this legislation. I think that's why the intensity is so much on the side of the Republicans right now in this issue, and why only 37% of Americans support this. Nancy Pelosi is right. The American people are afraid. She's just not listening.
Well said. I think her speakership's in jeopardy. This gets passed or not, Congress now is close now to the lowest approval number that they've ever had. Do you agree with that?
Yes, the Unabomber has a higher favorability rating than some members of Congress right now.
Oh,
it really is that bad.
That sounds like a McGurk line. He's joining us later. All right. Tom Cobra, we highlighted him earlier in the program, commenting on the dishonesty of the Democrats using his PBO numbers. Roll it there.
We saw a 4 today on this. And it just shows you Washington playing games with American people. A score of $100 billion in savings over the next 10 years. Where's the NCR fixing that? Where's the payment? You think that the Congress is going to allow a 22% cut in physician payments in light of the fact that we're going to have physicians running out of here anyway? And to not score that within the context of this bill, it's not only smoke and mirrors, it's flat-out dishonest.
Flat-out dishonest. Now, one of the things, I brought this up with Eric Cantor earlier, Frank, and that is that, first of all, we're paying taxes on this bill for 4 years. The gimmick, the trickery, the parliamentary maneuvers, the bribes, I've never seen corruption like this in my lifetime, and since I was a young kid, I've been following politics. Is that message getting through?
And it's interesting to use this word corruption because that's what more and more Americans are saying. We've asked that question in focus groups and polls, and it's one of the reasons why the public is trusting Congress less and less. Even Democrats, people who voted for Barack Obama, have lost some faith in Congress. But it's the other item, and I ask a rhetorical question. Do you believe that you can add a $1 trillion program to federal spending and reduce the deficit and reduce the debt? Do you actually believe that you can create a brand new mandatory benefit of $1 trillion and then in the end Washington will end up spending less? Sean, the answer to that rhetorical question by almost every American is a flat-out no. We see the results of this in the midterm elections. All the polls suggest we will. And I'll tell you something. The intensity is all on the Republican side. The American people, no matter what state you're in, are frustrated. It's why Republicans won in Virginia, New Jersey, and most recently in Massachusetts. This could shape up to 1994 all over again. I agree with you, and we'll be talking a lot about that in the days and weeks to come. Frank, appreciate you being with us. Time now to check in with Greta. Oh, you're not paying attention again. What, so am I boring you?
I'm busy. I only have 64 more hours.
Did you see this thing?
Look at the size of it. I mean, this whole thing. Can you put the camera down? 60. I mean, you know, 64 more hours. Look at
this. Good luck. You know what? Great lifetime reason. Do you think we're going to have the speed reader guy back on the program?
I know, it's just insane. I got 64 hours to read this. I'll find a Carson Boehner tonight and Senator Mary Landrieu. But I'm way too busy to read this, John. I don't have time for this team to do this.
Don't sleep in the next 64 hours. We're going to watch it very closely. Go ahead in 20 minutes. Let not your heart be troubled. When we come back, the great, 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 the Milligan Panel.
Easy-to-use tools to help you discover what your numbers mean and how the things you do